You're listening to Dig Deep on Northern Community Radio. We have in the studio with us Aaron Brown, our liberal commentator, Chuck Marone, our conservative. We've been talking infrastructure. You've taught me to not glaze my eyes over. And now we move into transportation. Where do we want to go? Where do we begin?
It's fascinating because a few years ago here in Minnesota, the Department of Transportation came out with this report that said they needed $50 billion to maintain and make strategic investments in transportation. Then they came out a year later when they were actually asking for funding and said, you know what, we think we could maybe get by with $20 billion, but that's going to be like cutting it back. Then when it started to go through the sausage making at the legislature, they said, okay, if we go to maintenance only, we're still probably going to not have enough, but let's try $10 billion. And now we're talking somewhere around six. So what has happened is we have built, much like our underground infrastructure, our above ground infrastructure, we have built a lot of roads. Back in the early highway building days, the federal government would give you 90 cents on the dollar for anything new you built. They wouldn't give you that to maintain it, but they would give you that to build it. And the more you built, the more money you got. And so there was this huge incentive to build more and more and more. And what we found is that we became very good at cashing in on that. We built a lot of roads, a lot of highways, and a lot of local county roads and other, you know, other roads of dubious quality in terms of their necessity and what we get for them. We built all over the place because we could get the money to build them. And now we're finding that going back and fixing them and maintaining them is an enormously expensive proposition, one that we just don't have the stomach for. Taxpayers seem to be saying they want them fixed, but they also don't want to pay anything more. And as Thomas Jefferson said years ago, it's the downfall of democracy is when you want more service than you're willing to pay for. And when it comes to transportation, we've kind of set up a system designed to do just that.
I think it's really exacerbated in northern Minnesota and places like Maine and northern climates too, where things like paved roads need a lot of maintenance. You can't get by for more than 5 or 7 years and you've got some serious problems with your roads. What we've gotten in the habit of, I think, with maintenance, and this is just me observing as a driver and as a minor actor in local policy, is we need to really fix this road. We can't afford that. Well, we're gonna lay some more overlay on it and call it good for a few more years. And of course, frost and water being what they are, you see over time, well, this just was putting it off. You spent the money then a little bit and you still have the same problem. But I would like to talk about one thing. I got to tell this story. It's kind of family legend. My grandfather in Keewatin was very briefly a city councilor. Very briefly. One term. One and done. And
scandal?
No. Well, yes, in a way. He and the rest of the city council didn't fare very well because they had the misfortune of being in office when the city was bypassed by State Highway 169. And it was a state highway that if you drive by Keewatin now, you look over the town, you like from a like in a fishbowl, you look from above and look down at the city. Of course, you're looking at what was the backside of Keewatin, the side that they did not intend for people to see. So you see the trailer park and you see the, you know, relatively low income housing. Can't even see the main street. You can't see any of the parts of the city that once were the center. You just see the back side. But anyway, this highway bypassed the city. It really, and as you know, when a small town is bypassed like that, the downtown suffers. There's no more foot traffic. There's no more traffic coming through town. But he was in office when the state engineer came to tell them about the project and ask for their support. Well, it was asking as though it wasn't really asking for their support. They're saying, this is what the state is doing.
Are you going to tie yourself to a tree and lay
you,
down?
Would you, you know, we would love it if we had your backing on this. And what they promised was a cross-range expressway that would connect from the one end of the Mesabi Iron Range to the other here in Grand Rapids, a four-lane highway, a modern highway. This was in the 1960s. That would be just like the interstate system. It was the years of just after Eisenhower when the modern American automobile was still a vogue thing. And this was the promise, and my grandfather and the other councilors voted for it and offered their support. And I remember being very young when just becoming aware of what politics even was. And the very first political issue I was introduced to was how my grandpa got screwed on that deal because they never did finish the Cross Range Expressway. They bypassed Keewatin, but from just west of Pengilly to, well, at the time, Coleraine, there was a single lane of highway that wove around old mining locations, and that never got finished. But it's still driving discussion about transportation in northern Minnesota, that highway.
Well, this story points out the base conflict that we have with transportation across this country that is embodied in, you know, the legislation that Eisenhower approved in the 1950s. It is transportation to connect distant places with high-speed access, or is it a way to drive local development and investment? And what we see is that if you ask politicians, they will say yes. It is both of those. But what we find is that in a practical sense, those two goals conflict. If you are building a range, what did you call the?
Cross-range expressway.
A cross-range expressway. The idea is that you want people to be able to get from one side of this region to the other very quickly. You don't want things that would slow them down. You want them to be able to get on and off at a city, but you basically, the benefit of that is we can move very, very quickly. If you're the local city council member, or even more importantly, if you're the local guy who owns the piece of land out on the edge of town, you're not as interested in people getting across the range as quickly as possible. You're interested in selling that piece of property to whoever would be willing to develop it and essentially use this massive public investment that's been made by the state to increase the value of your property and get a quick payoff. We have had this conflict everywhere across this country. And what it has kind of forced us to do is spend an enormous sum of money on a transportation system that subperforms what it otherwise should. And I think a lot of the frustration we have with transportation today is because we really are not able to identify what we're trying to do with it. Are we trying to connect places? Or are we trying to build places? Those are two separate things, and we treat them the same.
Can you do both of those things? Are they?
No, you can, but not at the same time. If you think about, I mean, we're sitting here in Grand Rapids today. And if you think about Grand Rapids as a place, it's really hard to have Grand Rapids be a successful place with travel speeds through the middle of it at 40 miles an hour. It makes it hard to keep a business running. It makes it hard to walk across the road to another business if you're a patron. It makes it hard to be in a neighborhood and get to the center of town. What it does is it takes that, and we'll go back to the first segment, where we talked about infrastructure underground by the foot, it takes everybody and it spreads them out in a way that, especially in a small town, is really, really, really expensive for us to keep. It forces this really high burn rate on us. When you get out of town then, if you have 45 mile an hour speeds, you're making these huge investments and you're not really even going very fast. It's a little bit like we need to pick one or the other. Is this going to be a high-speed corridor where we're really going to move cars, in which case ixnay to the development along it, you know, let's not do that. Or are we going to be in town where we're trying to actually get something going, in which case we have to slow speeds way, way, way down and focus on how much development we can get. We do both, and you wind up with the mile on the edge of every town where you can't drive very fast and you've got the Walmart and the Home Depot and all that stuff that just slows you down and costs a ton and doesn't produce a lot of tax base for you.
I've asked you this before, Chuck, and I almost don't want to ask you, but what about, so we're both from the Brainerd area.
Yeah.
When they put in those, on those corridors, those frontage roads.
Yeah. Well, you think about a frontage road, and it is almost like the ultimate excess of American style of development. Nowhere would our ancestors, remember how we talked about how you get enough people and then you could have the waterworks and you'd get enough people and you can put in wooden sidewalks. They were so frugal because they had to be. Now imagine if you went to them and said, hey, not only are you going to be able to put in all the infrastructure that you ever wanted, you know, all the pipes, all the stuff, but you can put it in and only have access on one side of the road. Like the whole other side, just don't even bother with. We'll just like forget about it. They would think that that was insane because they wouldn't have the money to do it. We don't have the money to do it either. We just pretend we do in the short term. So when you see a frontage road, what you are seeing is you are seeing a city literally just burn money, just throw it away without getting anything back for it.
Couple things on that. First, that reminds me of a point I've been meaning to bring up is I don't know how you were with this, Chuck, but the original computer game version of SimCity.
Yeah, yeah. No, Obsession. Yeah.
Yeah. So I remember playing that game and it was kind of looking back, it didn't teach me much about engineering cities that worked well or anything like that, but it taught me that when you have a lot of money and you just build stuff, you can kind of see what happens. And sometimes it's kind of cool to just keep building, you know, rather than waiting and maintaining. And I think when you talk about frontage roads, it's like a road wrapped in a road. It's like a bacon,
right.
Like a burger wrapped in bacon. I mean, it's like, it's like, yes, let's do that because then the people can go fast here and slower here. But one of the things I wanted to bring up in talking about this urge to build, especially in the small towns and in rural regions like northern Minnesota, is locally for the local political structure. And I'm talking again about people like my grandpa was, the city councils, the mayors. You know, they're not necessarily engineers. Some might be. They have some paid staff, but oftentimes it's people on the front or back end of their career who end up in these small town jobs. And how strong the political demand is for them to deliver something and something people can see. And I know, having worked with people in the legislature and at state level as well, that this urge from in the politics of running for election and re-election, but also in the dealing with your communities in a district, for instance. And I don't any district up here would have the same kind of pressures, Republican or Democratic. But this strong urge to build is a big. There's no political advantage in being prudent and restrained in how you develop your town. You can say 50 years from now, people will be glad we're not broke.
There is in theory, but not in practice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, even you take the conservative philosophy that we're going to save money. I think that's a good idea in concept, but what ends up happening is we're going to cut the budget for this and this, the things we don't like, that our constituents don't like. We're going to dramatically cut that budget. But don't worry, we're still going to pave streets and roads. I mean, we see it right now with a very conservative Republican Party or increasingly conservative Republican Party in terms of politics. They come out and they propose big cuts to health and human services. But don't worry, folks, we're still going to get you roads and bridges. Don't worry about it. We still got you on that.
There's like a 95% approval rating for infrastructure spending. And I don't want to speak ill of St. Oberstar in any way. That being said, you look at the success of his political career, and a large part of it was because he sat on the most important committee for handing out the bacon, you know, the big transportation projects. You drive around the range, and I'm a person who travels all over the country. The Iron Range to me is bizarre in terms of the transportation infrastructure. And I know a lot of our listeners have probably gotten used to it, but you have 4-lane divided highways where you don't have the traffic counts to support, you know, 4 lanes, period. And it's funny because I say this to people and they're like, oh, but I drive that all the time. Yeah, I'm sure you do. But you can go to other parts of the country where they have traffic counts that are 3, 4, 5 times higher, and they don't have 4-lane divided highways. I mean, they have 2 lanes through the middle of nowhere. We have very low traffic counts and we have gold-plated infrastructure. The problem is now we have to maintain all this stuff. It was great when we had the ribbon cutting. It was great when we could, you know, pretend that it would lead to some kind of growth that would make us all rich and wealthy. That didn't happen. And now this stuff is rotting out in the sunlight, and we have to go out and fix it. And we don't have the money to do that. It's brutally, brutally expensive. So what are we going to take money away from? Education? We're going to take money away from social services? Where are we going to get the money to do this? And I think that is the kind of downside of this 95% agreement that we should spend a bunch of money on infrastructure, because at the end of the day, we're just creating more and more liabilities for ourselves.
From your travels and seeing other places and their infrastructure and roads, is there a good example?
No. And I would say that not to be like, you know, Mr. Depression, but, you know, we live in a federal system. Our funding for local infrastructure no longer relies on us having a whole bunch of people here, can put in the waterworks, and we'll get more people and we'll put in the wooden sidewalks. our ability to build infrastructure relies on our political connections. So you go to all these cities, they all have lobbyists now. They all have people who are working on their behalf on the bonding committee and what have you to try to get money to do big projects. And Donald Trump wants to drop $1 trillion on infrastructure at the federal level, largely borrowed money, maybe some leveraging of private capital, but $1 trillion. And we all nationwide are kind of beholden to that system. It's very top down, it's very centralized, and it's very disconnected from, you know, what is actually needed or what is actually beneficial at the local level. This is why Representative Oberstar did a lot of great things. And again, I don't want to disparage him in any way. Clearly, he's not here to defend himself. I think if we look at the record of the infrastructure spending, we'll see a lot of projects that were, you know, given a lot of fanfare when they were put in, a lot of ribbon cuttings. But now there's people not only in St. Paul, but there's a lot of people, you know, at the district office here going, what in the world? Our budget is a tiny fraction of what would be needed to maintain this stuff. And even if in some bizarre world we doubled our budget, we're still not even close. The implications of that are pretty huge. We actually have more stuff than we can take care of. And that means that over time, the complications that Aaron talked about, you know, we can see some of this stuff declining, that is going to accelerate. And accelerate here in rural areas in ways that you're not seeing down in the metropolitan area, where there's a lot more money and a lot more money locally.
And having known Congressman Oberstar a little and certainly following his career, and of course the history there goes back beyond Oberstar. You know, his mentor and former employer was John Blotnick, who was the representative who held the seat from right after World War II. So from World War II to 2010, think about that span of time, two guys who both ended up chairing the Transportation Infrastructure Committee were sending their
lots of money
and influence home. But I know what the response would be. And the response would be, do the people of rural areas of northern Minnesota, of these working class mining communities, deserve less? You know, and this is the question is, yes, that, you know, 53 should be a four lane, they would say. They would say the range should have a clean and safe modern highway system. Not just the range, but everywhere should. That was certainly the philosophy that guided Jim Oberstar and his predecessor, John Blotnick. And so I think one of the things to sort out here is there's the engineering side where the SimCity thinking side,
right?
You know, where we're going to think and learn from our experiences, and maybe overbuilding is a problem. And then there's the world that has politics in it, where people like these projects and end up voting for them, whether they're conservative or liberal. And then the people live here. So how do we unwrap this system in a way that doesn't disproportionately affect the rural and the poor more than the urban and the wealthy?
And I think that's our big challenge right now, because what you see, and we've seen some tumultuous politics here on the range with party switching and all kinds of changing allegiances in the way that I don't know as we would have predicted 20 years ago when this was solid DFL territory. But you look just in a macro sense at the state, power is shifting to the metro area, to the suburbs. Minneapolis is growing in population. The inner ring suburbs are growing in population. The outer ring suburbs, the exurbs, are not. Rural areas are not. And when you just look at that shift in power, there's always been a net outflow of money. Contrary to what a lot of people believe here in the Iron Range and in rural Minnesota, from a transportation dollar standpoint, there's always been a net outflow from the 7-county metro to rural Minnesota. That light rail line that's being proposed, we're not paying for that here. They're paying for our 4-lane highway in the middle of the woods. That's the way the money flows in this state. And it's very popular in rural areas to call for devolution. You know, let's have local governments do this stuff. I think we might reach a point where the Minneapolis-St. Paul folks take us up on that. And that would mean a dramatic shift in the amount of money we have here to do basic things.
One of the concepts I explored was this idea that has existed where there'd be a new state, the state of Superior, mm-hmm. and northern Minnesota, northern Wisconsin, and the UP of Michigan would all form this new state based on our rural northern values and our resources and things like that. And one of the questions that always dogged me when I was researching this, it's actually still a viable movement in the UP, they still talk about it, is my goodness, how would they pay for the highways? Because without those urban centers paying the taxes, you lose the ability to pay for those.
It would be over. And that's the, I think there's got to be a humble part of how we approach this, saying the Twin Cities do need rural Minnesota. I think they would argue that they need a connection between Brainerd and Grand Rapids and Grand Rapids and Hibbing. They don't necessarily need all the frontage roads and the county roads off to the side and all the other things that tend to suck up a lot of money but not produce a lot of benefit.
In our next segment, we'll look at infrastructure from a broadband point of view. This is Dig Deep.